In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome to the I Spy Radio Show. So glad you're joining us today on what should be an especially fun and entertaining show for the Iowa caucuses, less than 10 days away, which is the official start to the presidential race. All these debates and polls and nonsense have just been really the warm-ups. We're offering an in-depth look at how we go about electing a president. Today's show is a presidential politics primer, if you will. Before the general election in November, there's an entire process involved to even narrow things down to those final two candidates from the two major parties. The third party candidates have never won, so we're just going to pretend they don't exist, at least for today's show. So how does all of this work? How has this changed over the years? And what are some of the dirty tricks of politics you often hear about, like brokered conventions and so on? On today's show, we'll take a historical look at how this process has unfolded and help you better understand how the system works. And if we inspire you to get involved and make sure that you vote in the primary, all the better. To do all of that, I'd like to welcome Greg Leo. He is our go-to guy for all things historical and political. Greg is the owner of the Leo Company. He has been a political consultant with more than 40 years of experience. Greg, it is always an honor to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be on the show.
Yeah, I'd like to start with kind of the overall presidential election, the national side of things, and then we're going to start drilling down into both party and state politics deeper into the show. But let's start with some of the history of the presidential election process to kind of get a foundation for how things are today. And then in the next segment, we'll talk about the modern day election process. So how do we elect the president? How we elect the president today, I should say, is very different from what the founders originally envisioned. Because despite what most people think, we do not actually directly elect a president. So I'd like to start with that process itself, because we aren't exactly electing or casting our vote directly for a president. Instead, we're really telling our electors who we want to vote for. So what exactly is an elector, and why did our founders decide to use that particular system?
Well, going back to the U.S. Constitution, which is always a great place to start on any question, you go to Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which outlines really the Electoral College. Now, the Electoral College is a means of the states to have individual elections and then to aggregate together the number of electors necessary to win. So the magic number is 270. You need 270 electoral votes to win. And as you know, we do not have popular election, although there has been an effort in recent years. National Popular Vote has been pushing to try to make it, popular election being the determining factor. But it has not passed and been ratified by the state, so we are still a function of the Electoral College. So what happens is the individual states will vote at the general election, which is November 8th of this year. And then the first week in January, the electors for the candidate who wins will go to their state capital and will cast their Electoral College votes. Then those go to Washington, D.C., and the new president will be sworn in, really, a year from this last week. And January 20th, 2017, will be inaugurating the next president of the United States.
Yes, isn't it fun to imagine that, or to know that the Obama administration has less than a year of existence. But in terms of using the electors, was that an entirely new system, or had other governments used that previously?
No, this was invented here because really when the Constitution was written, there had been really no republic that relied on the states. And remember, early on, we were really a confederation of states.
That's right.
So we did, these United States became the United States after the Civil War, basically. So, you know, the Electoral College is really puts the brakes on the popular madness of crowds, if you will. I think the founding fathers were suspicious of popular elections and thought that it was important that we have processes where individual states had their say and that the electors, who really are supposed to be senior people with good judgment, are able then to get together, cast their votes in the Electoral College. So it's a way to have checks and balances to make sure that elections cannot be stolen, first of all, and second of all, that the rights of the states were represented.
Well, and they were rightfully suspicious of the so-called wisdom of the crowds, because you can certainly see that even in modern-day politics, where you have a whole bunch of people voting for who's going to give them, who has offering the most giveaways. And so
well,
I think there's
a famous recent example, of course, is Bush v. Gore, you know, where we had, you know, George Bush won the Electoral College vote and, you know, Gore won the popular vote. So, and the popular vote it's so variable when you take it across the entire expanse of the country and different voting systems and different states, different state laws. And so the way that the Founding Fathers thought it was important was to recognize individual states. So in a way, a presidential election is, you know, 50 individual elections which aggregate together through the Electoral College to actually choose the next leader of the free world.
Well, and it really is interesting, too, as you take that historical look back at what they were doing, where it was balancing the will of the people and also tempering the power of the government, because they did not want all that power concentrated in one person. In fact, the original Constitution was the president and vice president were not even elected on the same ticket.
Yeah, and the vice president, of course, was originally elected by the Senate, you know, and still serves as president of the Senate. But now, and I can't remember the exact change when that occurred, but the vice president is, of course, elected with the president as part of that ticket.
Yes. What is interesting, too, is as you look at that, the very first election, we didn't even have all of the states involved. There were two states that hadn't even ratified the Constitution yet. In fact, there were no political parties either. You were either a Federalist, labeled as such, because you were in favor of ratification, or an Anti-Federalist, because you did not favor ratification. And so talk to us about that very first election. I mean, because you know, everybody knows that Washington was elected unanimously, but then you had 11 other candidates that were also up for office.
Well, as America was kind of feeling its way into being a country, you know, one of the questions was, would we have a monarch? And, you know, George Washington, of course, said he did not want to be the monarch, that it was, you know, he would agree to be president, but didn't think that we as a republic, you know, should have a monarch. And so he was offered the kingship, turned it down, said that he would govern, but only for a certain amount of time. And so I think he served his two terms. And during that time, of course, we had the Articles of Confederation and other kinds of definition, which provided, you know, for the election and for the, you know, how the government would organize. The political parties are private organizations. They are not part of the government. And so people need to keep that in mind, that even today, you know, the Republican Party and Democratic Party are two principal parties in this country, are really private organizations.
Yes.
that operate by rules that they create. And so over time, you know, parties have evolved. I mean, the Whigs basically became Republicans, and, you know, the parties have really juxtaposed in many ways since the Civil War.
Yes. Yep.
Where different regions and different issues have created formation, reformation, and ever-changing you know, associations, which are really the basis for parties.
Yes. So actually, let's go ahead and take a break right here. Coming back, we're going to take a deeper look at some of those parties. And stay tuned. We'll be getting into some more of the dirtier aspects of some of these party politics. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today about the presidential politics and the whole process of all of that. And to do that, we're talking with Greg Leo. He is our go-to guy for all things historical and political. He's the owner of the Leo Company, where he has been a political consultant for more than 40 years. And Greg, we were talking about this notion of having the president and vice president actually elected separately, as originally conceived by the founders. And, you know, it's really fascinating to think about that. I mean, here's a situation, if you were to look at that in modern day terms, you could essentially have a Trump presidency and a Hillary Clinton vice presidency. I can't imagine things would work out very well in Washington.
It would be difficult. And in fact, when we did have that, originally under Article 2, Section 1, Clause 3 in the Constitution, that is the one that creates the Electoral College, we did have a problem with favorite sons being elected and thereby having two different parties represented. So the 12th Amendment of the Constitution was provided in December of 1803 in order to fix that. And basically they did, and so now the parties will nominate a president and a vice president who will serve on the same ticket, and that keeps split party leadership from happening and provides better consistency for national administration.
So I imagine the reason they did that is because they were so still concerned about that centralization of power and too much power being accumulated either in one person or even in one party. Is that your guess as to why they did it that way?
Parties were shorting themselves out. In the 1796 election, John Adams from the Federalist Party, he was the Federal Party candidate, but the Federalist electors scattered on the second vote. And so they elected the Democratic Republican Party. Apparently, both of those were that party. And his name was Thomas Jefferson. And
that's
so
right.
we know that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had a very divergent points of view. And it was so confusing at that point for the country that in 1800, they proposed the 12th Amendment. And the 12th Amendment then was ratified over the course of, it looks like, about 4 years. And finally, on September 25th, 1804, it was determined that they would run as a ticket. And so that's why we have the president and the vice president running on the same ticket.
So we gradually shifted towards a more centralized government and giving the federal government more and more power. And certainly we saw that happen there in the Civil War. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about how this process continued to evolve and also the rise, really, of political parties? Because, you know, as we said, the very first election, they didn't even have political parties. But so talk to us about the influence then of the political parties on the process.
Well, you know, political parties are associations of people around ideas. Citizens gather around common ideas, and in a way, it's a shorthand for belief systems. So, you know, early on, we had a conflict between people who wanted the strong central government and those that wanted more distribution of power throughout the states. And so, you know, the original conflict between the Jeffersonians and the Hamiltonians, you know, Jefferson being populist, wanting distribution of power, and, you know, Hamilton wanting a strong central government, that was really the first point that parties were established. But they've, over time, they've evolved and they've changed. And that's a good thing because, you know, political opinion and belief systems do evolve over time. And so at the time of the Civil War, we had a major change. Of course, the Whig Party pretty much disappeared, some of it going to Abraham Lincoln, who was really a reformer, and the brand new party called the Republican Party, which was founded in 1856 in Ripon, Wisconsin, but really was popularized by the idea of ending slavery. The Democratic Party split in the election of 1860, you know, with Breckinridge and our own Governor Lane of Oregon as vice presidential running mate, you know, splitting the vote with the Northern Democrats. So slavery issues split the Democratic Party, and that elected Abraham Lincoln, and really kind of set up, you know, the conflict of the Civil War, where the party in power wanted union and wanted to abolish slavery and eventually did. And the party outside wanted more of an agrarian system where slavery was part of the economic model and wanted states' rights and the ability to nullify laws and to secede, you know, from the union if they could. And they tried to and didn't. So the Civil War was really the critical point at which the country became unified, and the politics, in a way, became stabilized, where Republicans controlled for almost 70 years up until Grover Cleveland from the election of 1860. So that really set the stage for modern political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, but they have changed dramatically over time.
Yes, yeah, they sure have.
Both regionally and ideologically.
Well, before we leave the process entirely, because I do want to delve a little bit more into both parties, then also the whole notions of conventions and how the candidates are themselves elected. But in reality, we're not really electing a president, as we discussed previously. We're actually telling our state's electors the citizens' preference. And this, of course, in the general election, not the primary. But in this day and age, do presidential electors have to follow the will of the people, or do they have some legal means that they could suddenly decide to vote for someone else?
They do. They sign a pledge. And I was a presidential elector for the Republican Party in the last cycle, although I did not get to cast a vote because Oregon, did not vote for the popular vote, did not reflect the Republican candidate. But we do sign loyalty oaths, and we're required at the time that we run to be a presidential elector to say that you will vote for that party, for your party's nominee. The unfaithful elector can be disciplined, too, in a way where that vote could be cast but not counted. And really, unless it's done in an organized way, it would not have any effect, I think. So it is important that there be faithful electors, not just in the Electoral College, but also in the nomination process.
You said they could be disciplined somehow. What exactly does that mean? I mean, you're signing an oath, but is there a legal obligation of some sort in addition to that oath?
Yeah, I think when you swear the oath, you legally say that you will support your party's nominee. And then I think it's also there's a moral aspect to it. You're giving your word of honor that you will be voting for that party's nominee. How is this enforced? Your vote could be counted, but probably wouldn't matter. Probably wouldn't mean much.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the states and the different approaches, especially caucus versus primary, and any other oddities. Stay with us. Lots more with Greg Leo. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. It's a presidential political primer. Boy, that's a fun one. A presidential political primer to understand the process of how we go about electing a president. Very different here in the United States versus European countries. And to do that, we were talking with Greg Leo. He is an amateur historian and a longtime political consultant with more than 40 years of experience going back all the way to the Reagan administration. And Greg, I'd like to kind of shift the focus now a little bit. Now that we have a better understanding of the presidential process on the general election side of things, but in terms of actually getting the candidates to become the banner bearer for their individual parties, I think that's kind of an interesting process in itself. And you've got two different ones. One is a caucus system versus a primary system. Here in Oregon, we use a primary system. I think most people understand that. You go in, you cast your vote, and you're done. Caucuses are very different. So why don't you go ahead and describe that system for us?
Well, the caucus system is where Republicans will get together, in certain jurisdictions, and they will meet and then vote to support one of the candidates. And so let me start from the beginning and say that, how presidential nominees happen is by party rules. And so the rules of the Republican Party, which are adopted at each Republican National Convention, so the ones we're operating under were adopted in Tampa at the last convention, they have a number of rules. And the famous rule that a lot of people know about is Rule 16C, which is about the timing. We see every state trying to move their primary earlier so that they get more attention and, frankly, more money. They get a lot more media and people coming to their states in the snows of Iowa because Iowa is the first state. So the rules of the party say that each state party, really, and state law shall affect a way of determining the delegates to the national convention. Now, there's 2,472 delegates to the Republican National Convention, and they come in all sorts of different varieties, and I'll kind of describe them. But basically, the party rules provide for at-large delegates based on population, and then district delegates that are based on congressional districts. Each of the state parties, and there are also places like American Samoa that are represented, and the district, they get party leaders. So their state party chair, their national committee man and woman are what we call superdelegates. And then there's a whole system in the Republican Party of getting bonus delegates. So if you won your presidential campaign 4 years ago, you get a certain number of delegates. If you have a Republican governor, you get a certain number of delegates. The members of the House and the Senate, you get more delegates. And then the chambers of the, you know, both the legislative chambers, you get additional delegates. So that's why performance really matters about who is going to be nominating in the Cleveland convention in July. It's July 18th through the 21st in Cleveland, Ohio.
Greg, let me interrupt you real quick there.
Yeah, go ahead.
So to be clear, if I heard you right, if you were like, let's say a Santorum or Romney that had won last year or last go around, you said they get delegates as well?
No, the states get the delegates, not the candidates. So, for example, if Mitt Romney won, for example, he won in Texas, Texas gets 28 additional delegates. As their
I see what you're saying now. Okay.
Presidential bonus delegates. So not all states are equal, and states are given delegates based on political performance under the rules of the Republican Party. So that's why whoever will be nominated needs to get 1,237 delegates, which is 50% of the 2,472 Republican convention delegates.
I see.
So the point is not, and so some states are way more important than others. And so, for example, Alabama has a total of 50 delegates. Oregon has a total of 28 delegates because Oregon gets no bonus delegates. It just gets its allocation of 10, state delegates. And then because we have 15 congressional delegates and we get 3 super delegates. So that's how we get to 28 here in Oregon. So that's why we have flyover states. There are states like Oregon that we will not see presidential candidates. And then we have states like Iowa where they're there every single day bringing lots of tourism money and hotel room reservations and media exposure to the states. And so the states have all tried to push their processes before March 1st. And so what we have now is February 1st, we'll have the Iowa caucus, which is essentially a series of meetings where they allocate the 30 Republican delegates based on the popular vote at the, not popular vote, but at the vote at the individual caucuses. New Hampshire is a primary, and it's mixed. I think the question is whether independent voters can vote in New Hampshire. I believe they can. As I see, it's not closed just to members of that party, but rather non-affiliated voters can choose, which makes it a very interesting election from a popular vote point of view.
Yes,
Nevada
sure
has a caucus on the 20th of February, and I'm sorry, on the 23rd for the Republicans, and so it goes.
Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and actually take a break right there because I've got lots of questions and it's going to take more time than we have. Everyone stay with us. Lots more with Greg Leo talking about the presidential primary process. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Greg Leo, a longtime political consultant and our go-to guy for anything historical or political, and we're talking about the presidential races and how all of this breaks down, trying to help you understand the process a little bit more. And Greg, during the break there, we started talking about the differences between, say, Oregon and Idaho. Oregon is a more popular state, and yet it has fewer delegates there at the convention. Why don't you go ahead and break that down for us?
Sure. In Idaho, they'll have 32 delegates to the Republican convention. In Oregon, we'll have 28. So how does a smaller state by population get more delegates? And the answer is, you know, they won the presidential election. So Mitt Romney won Idaho, and for that, he gets 7 additional votes. And then, you know, they've elected congressmen and a senator that we haven't, and they have control of both the House and the Senate in the state legislature. And so for all those reasons, they get bonus delegates. So the, you know, bonus delegates make a huge difference. Oregon has none because we have not performed politically in order to earn those. And so the nominee will be chosen by the one that gets 1,237 votes, some of which are allocated by popular vote, some of which are allocated by caucus. And the real determining date, and I will say this here as a prediction, that we will know the Republican nominee on the 15th of March. So as Julius Caesar would say, beware of the Ides of March. And that I'm really quoting Karl Rove, he said in an article. But the two big states, Florida and Ohio, both have their primaries on the 15th of March. And so, of course, Ohio has 66 delegates. And let me see, Florida here. Florida has 99.
Yeah.
So 99 in Florida, 66 in Ohio. And those big electoral vote states will also be the big states that determine the nominee.
So you can certainly understand from an outsider's view, in terms of people that are not really familiar with these kind of inside party politics types of issues, you can certainly see why they begin to see that this is kind of manipulated by party insiders. I mean, it doesn't seem to make sense, I would think, for most people. Why? Simply because Idaho, they had picked Romney in the last one, why they would get bonus delegates this time. And that, I think, doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people, because, you know, last election shouldn't necessarily matter for this election, should it?
Well, you know, there's a lot of rules in American life that are pretty similar. I mean, you know, economic rules, and, you know, those who produce are benefit. And that's really the way the system is designed, that political performance is very, very important. And so when you live as a Republican in a blue state, just realize that you don't have the influence of being a Republican in a red state where your performance is better. So remember, these are private party rules that they're made by the states that have the delegates at the convention. So naturally, they will benefit those where they do better.
So if Oregon wants more delegates at the next convention, not this one, but the one coming up in 2020, they need to pick the winner in this year's election. Is that correct?
Yeah, we need to campaign hard and win Oregon for the nominee. And that's, I mean, we've done that before. We did it twice with Ronald Reagan, but we haven't done it since. And so the idea is that nothing succeeds like success in politics. If you are able to win your state, which is the primary thing in a presidential election, you not only get great tickets at the inaugural, but you actually get an opportunity to have more delegates at the next convention 4 years later.
Yeah, and that's interesting, too, because it kind of bleeds into the whole notion of all of these conservatives abandoning people like a Trump. And this is not at all an endorsement of Trump, but you can certainly see how that would impact things later on down the road. Because if, you know, you're going to want to, as the eventual nominee, you're going to want to reward the people that supported you, not the people that opposed you. And so it seems to me that that might be a tactical error by some of these conservative leaders that are saying, oh, well, Trump is the worst thing ever. We would rather vote for Hillary versus a Trump. That actually is going to remove them from a seat at the table, will it not?
It actually marginalizes things in the long run. I mean, what we should all be thinking of is how do we win our state, you know, and who, I guess the who is important because that's how we can attract support. But, you know, having the you know, the Electoral College votes from Oregon being cast next January in Salem and then being tallied in Washington, D.C. to create the whoever's standing up there on the podium on the 20th of, you know, January next year, less than a year from today, is what's going to make all the difference. So it's really about political performance, not about ideology.
That's right. And so we got about a minute and a half here with you. In terms of the primaries followed by the general election, this is not the way that it was always done, correct? Wasn't it always basically prior to then you would have the real party insiders and the people that were actively involved in this, they would choose the candidate, would they not?
Yes, and things really changed, I think, with the progressive movement at the end of the last century or beginning of the last century, where you know, delegates and really even U.S. senators were not directly elected until, you know, the early 1900s. And so, you know, there were in the past bosses that were in smoke-filled rooms. But since the rise of the primary, we really haven't had brokered conventions. And so one of the things is, well, what if you know, the front runner doesn't get enough votes on the first ballot? Then the rule says you go to multiple ballots. And
yes.
In the past, we've had, for example, President Garfield, I think, was chosen on the 32nd ballot, and he was not a candidate. They actually reached outside of the candidates to find a office holder who's a true public servant who they know could win, and they picked James Garfield. And so we have not had a brokered convention in the Republican Party since Eisenhower beat Stassen in 1952. And then with the advent of television, when conventions get messy, it hurts your party's you know, prospects. I think the great example of that is the 1968 Democratic Convention, where the streets of Chicago were rioting and Richard Nixon ended up being elected. So, you know, parties are very careful about the politics going into presidential years to make sure that they don't appear to be unfair and that they can embrace the greatest amount of popular support.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You do not want your team looking like a dysfunctional family, although judging by the success of the Kardashians, maybe that would work in today's political age. All right, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Lots more with Greg coming up. We still haven't gotten around to the caucus versus primary, so we're going to break that down for you as well. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Greg Leo, talking about the process of electing a presidential candidate and then, of course, going on to the general election. Fascinating discussion in terms of the history of all of this and how this has unfolded into today's day and age. And I do want to come around to the notion, again, of a brokered convention and kind of look at some of the so-called dirty tricks that are available that could lead to something like that. But before we get there, though, I really would like to break down the notion of a caucus versus a primary. A caucus is very different from a primary because in a primary, you come in, cast your vote, and walk away, and that's it. Caucuses are much more involved. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about what those are?
Well, caucuses are great because, you know, individual voters or really individual precinct committee people, I should say, are able to get together in settings where they can talk to representatives of the candidates and really have dialogue. So it's really almost like sitting around your kitchen table having a discussion of who can you know, best represent us. And so we have an Oregonian, Caleb Hugel, is actually in Iowa now for one of the major presidential candidates. And what they have been doing is turning out their people, making sure that it is their Republicans who will end up going to the individual caucus meetings. And the presidential campaign that turns out the most supporters on these very snowy, you know, evenings to go to the caucuses, then get to make the selection. It's very different from Oregon, which is, of course, a presidential primary state where we all go to the vote this year on May 17th for the individual candidate that we like, and that's how the delegates to the convention are allocated in Oregon.
Well, and it is very much neighborhood situation. There are 1,744 precincts across Iowa, and so you can imagine this does really get down to very much, as you said, kind of around the kitchen table with that many precincts. In terms of the caucuses, you mentioned this idea of it being much more labor-intensive. Why do you need county chairs and those precinct captains? I mean, can't people just show up and throw their support behind one candidate or another, or do you need as a candidate, you need a representative in that room?
Well, I think you really do. I think that's part of the beauty of that process is you get to discuss the pros and cons, and if you bring expertise to the conversation, you have a better chance of getting the support of the people at the caucus. So, you know, the whole plan, as I understand what they're doing there, is each campaign is trying to turn their people out. What really matters is not turning them out in, you know, a mail-in ballot election like we have, but rather getting them to an actual meeting, which is so much harder for people to do. And the people who tend to show up at the meetings are the people who care and who are politically activists and people who have done it before. And so getting new people into the process is tougher, I think, in a caucus state rather than a primary state.
Well, Trump is especially being criticized for not having a large enough ground game there in Iowa. But does that mean if he doesn't have somebody, you know, like a precinct captain in that room, that people couldn't vote for Trump or, you know, any other candidate?
No, the party, this Iowa State Party, is organized that where anybody that's qualified, that's already on their list, you can vote for. So they don't necessarily have to have a Trump organizer there. And the interesting thing about Donald Trump is he's bringing out lots of people who are generally not active in the party. And so in a way, he's growing our party by bringing people in. The question is, will they have the coaching and the expertise to be at the right place at the right time, sitting at the right table, having the right credential, and being able to make arguments that then will persuade their friends and neighbors to support their candidate?
Yes, and you know, the Cruz supporters are very avidly behind and behind their candidate, and you know, very strong support. You know, it seems like if you're a Cruz supporter, you are definitely a Cruz supporter, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of changing of minds there. And so I could certainly see that you have those people in the room where you're talking one-on-one with somebody, and if you're very passionate about your candidate, you can certainly see how you could be able to persuade somebody for the vote that night.
Yeah, I can see a lot of the conservative religious base in the party turning out for Cruz. Mm-hmm. And they are people who generally do go to meetings. And if Oregon is any guide, there are people who are engaged in the process and vote.
Yeah. You know, the Iowa caucus gets a lot of the attention there, but other states that use a caucus system include Alaska, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, North Dakota, Kansas, and Minnesota. Do all of those operate pretty much the same way as Iowa, or do they have a very unique system on their own?
Every party has different party rules, and so it will be unique and different with all of these different parties. So Colorado, for example, has 37 delegates. And yeah, it's a closed process where only the Republicans will get to go to that caucus. And so this is the thing about presidential elections. They really are 50 different state elections. Mm. And from a state party point of view, the rules of the Republicans are different than the Democrats.
Yes. In fact, Iowa has a very different system in the sense that the Iowa Democrats, I should say, different from the Republicans in the sense that they have a viability check. Where you have to meet a certain level of minimum threshold of support, or that candidate is then disallowed. Let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some of those broker conventions and some of the other dirty tricks that you maybe have heard about at the convention. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Greg Leo talking about the presidential politics and giving you kind of a primer on that, how the whole system works. And I want to shift gears now into the conventions, because that's a fear of a lot of people. And regardless of what candidate that you end up supporting, there's always that fear in the back of your head that somehow they're going to get to the convention and you'll end up getting sabotaged. And a recent example of that is the Ron Paul people that tried to kind of sabotage the whole system. What they were doing was they were trying to have some dark horse convention delegates that said that they were there to vote for a Romney or whoever else it was that they were sent there for. And then at the convention, they were going to suddenly switch their vote and try to get Ron Paul in there. So there are some dirty tricks that are out there, and we want to address those. But before we get there, though, why don't you talk to us a little bit about how this has happened in the past and some of these, we'll say, the messier conventions.
In the messier conventions, you basically, you know, go into it with a very distributed set of support in the party. So there isn't any clear front runner, no clear winner. And so really, since the popular primary has created the means of selecting delegates, there have not been as many of these in recent history. So Oregon's primary system, for example, I mean, we will take the popular vote, and it'll be proportionately distributed between the candidates who are on the ballot. Some states have winner-take-all, which means that, you know, if one candidate who gets the highest number of votes gets all the delegates. But in our proportional system here in Oregon, you take the popular vote at the primary, we divide it up, and then those individuals run for those positions. And this time out, the state party has changed their rules somewhat, where instead of having, you know, five different congressional district conventions, we're going to have one convention, and at that time we'll elect the 10 Oregon delegates and then the congressional district delegates. The controversy that happened last time was not so much about the delegates as it was about the alternates. Mm-hmm. And that these meetings took so long that not all of the alternate votes occurred, and then they were alternates were then appointed. And that has still got a lot of people upset in certain counties here in Oregon. But at this particular point in time, it looks like there's going to be one meeting. At that point in time, the individuals who support individual candidates will be elected on a proportional basis.
In terms of the national convention itself, after all of the states have done their primaries and or caucuses, what exactly could lead to a brokered convention, and then how does that work should it come to that?
Well, if on the on March 15th, when we see the big states start to tumble in place with their primaries, if you find somebody below that 1,237 number, then you could have the possibility of a brokered convention. And generally what would happen there is that minor candidates would then start to coalesce with other candidates and to pledge their delegates to those other candidates. Now, we have a rule here in Oregon that if you are elected as a delegate, you can't switch until after the third ballot. Mm. So the rules of the convention are that they have multiple ballots, and then an Oregon delegate after the third ballot would then be able to vote for another candidate. So if you go in with not enough votes on the first ballot, and the more ballots you have, the more likelihood there will be shifting between, the support for various candidates. So a brokered convention, what that really means is that you have uncommitted delegates who are then able to vote for the candidates that they did not originally go to the convention to support. And generally that won't happen until after the third, but probably the fifth or sixth ballot.
Well, this whole notion then of a brokered convention really shows the importance of turning out for your particular candidate. I mean, imagine a situation where just picking someone out of the blue here, where Kasich managed to win one or two delegates here in Oregon, and suddenly those could have a really huge impact on the eventual candidate.
Well, the most important thing is that people vote at the primary election on the 17th of May. And that at that time, they support the candidate that they think best. And, by the time we vote, it should be pretty clear whether or not a candidate is getting close to the 1,237 delegates that they need. It could be all over but the shouting by the time they get to Oregon because we are so late in the process.
Well, speaking of that upcoming primary, to be clear, here in Oregon, you have to be a member of a party, either Democrat or Republican, in order to vote in those primaries, correct?
Absolutely, and that's the big reason to be a Democrat or a Republican and not to be a member of the Independent Party, because they don't really have much impact, any impact I can tell, on the presidential election. So if you're an Oregonian and you want to have a say about who's going to get nominated, be a member of a major party.
And when do you have to register by?
Well, it's 20 days prior to the May 17th election, so it'd be right in the last week of April.
Okay.
I believe there's 20-day rule in effect here in Oregon law.
Okay.
So the idea is, by March 15th, we're going to pretty well know if there's somebody who's a front runner, who's got the, delegate votes going into the convention. At least we'll start to see the trend at that point. And then by the time the Oregon primary happens, it could well be that, with Ronald Reagan, Oregon put Reagan over the top in 1980 with the correct number of delegates. So
yeah, and that would be pretty cool to have that happen this time around, have Oregon be the deciding vote on that. Greg, unfortunately, we're up against the clock here. I want to thank you so much for your time.
Good, thank you. And everybody get out and register and vote.
That's right. You can't participate unless you're on the field.
Exactly right.
That is all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show. I hope you enjoyed all of this as much as I did. Be sure to check today's website. We'll have some links up there to further expand on the process. The political process can certainly be a messy one, but good grief. Can you imagine a President Trump or Cruz, but a Vice President Hillary Clinton? Yikes. We have certainly come a long way, and I like the fact that everyday people can participate instead of party insiders picking our candidates. But you have got to vote. Sitting on the sidelines means you're letting someone else decide for you. So get registered and be sure to vote. To Because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.